Welcome to the Farm to Table Talk podcast, where we talk about our food system from what we eat to how it's grown. I'm your host, Roger Wasson.
Industrial farms have gone green. Can you believe it? Well, you should believe it, I guess, if you read the New York Times, and there was an interesting article that made that point. And I would think some of the people that read the New York Times are skeptical of that fact and tend to think that anytime you talk of factory farming and industrial farms, that it's a bad thing. And it's just we've gotten used to saying that everything should be small and local, organic, and so forth. And certainly now there's large-scale farms that are organic. But to come out and say that industrial farms are green, that's a little provocative. Well, someone that got that stirred up with a really thorough article in the New York Times is Dr. Jason Lusk at Oklahoma State University. And I'm really happy to say that Jason is with us on Farm to Table Talk. Jason, welcome to the table.
Thanks, Roger. Glad to be here.
So, Jason, explain this a little bit. You are an ag economist, and you must have a perspective that you've watched the criticisms build for how many years towards larger scale farming, which as an economist must rub you the wrong way, because oftentimes ag economists have been continuing to encourage farmers to get more and more efficient, and that was part of their job and help them understand what practices are efficient and making progress. And yet, when did this start bothering you that you were seeing that so many people were critical of large-scale farming or more industrialized type farming operations?
Right. I guess I'd say it's not necessarily that I cared so much about large versus small, although that's the way the piece in the New York Times came out. You know, when you're trying to please editors, you have to pitch things a certain way. But, you know, what I have been interested in for a long time is agricultural technology and what technology can do on the farm. And sometimes those technologies are more likely to be adopted by large-scale producers, or that technology can sometimes encourage some consolidation when people that don't adopt can't compete and they leave. And so the two things are related, but you know, I've been sort of paying attention mainly on the consumer side. That's most of my research, is studying consumer preferences and consumer demand for food and agricultural topics and issues. And you know, back in the biotechnology debate early on, there seemed to be some consumer aversion. That was sort of something I was paying attention to. And, you know, it's sort of stumbled into a whole lot of other issues, whether it's growth promotants or even herbicides today. And, you know, I think there's some legitimate fears that consumers have, but there's also been a lot of science about a lot of these issues. And I think when I started to at least start writing about these issues in a public way, instead of just academic audiences, was when I thought a lot of the arguments I saw in a lot of the papers and discussions like this podcast didn't seem to me to mesh well with what the best science was saying on some of these subjects. And particularly coming from an economist side, you know, the productivity gains are really, I think, what explains our increased sort of quality of life over time. That's how, you know, I guess economists say there's no free lunch, but the closest thing to a free lunch is a productivity gain, or in some cases, the value of agricultural research, because not always, but if done right, that whenever we have improvements in technology, it can both benefit the farmer and the consumer. And so that's something that economists and agroeconomists really pay attention to, is are we getting more productive? Are we able to get more output, more food from each unit of land, each unit of resource? And, you know, that sounds like a very economic thing, of course, right? Dollars and cents. We want to be more efficient. It sounds a little like, you know, greedy capitalist, and that's, of course, true a little bit. But I think it also ties into this issue of sustainability, too. And when I think about what sustainability means, it means to me that we want our grandkids to eat as well as we do. We want them to have the same kind of quality of life, standard of living that we do today. So we want to produce as much food as we're having today per person, while not using as much of our resources, or at least know more than our resources that we do today. And one of the ways we can do that is by becoming more efficient, more productive. If we can produce more corn on less land using less water, less fertilizer, then that to me is also one metric we can use to look at the sustainability or the greenness of our farms. And so it's that sort of perspective that I've tried to engage in and bring to the debate in a lot of different ways.
You've had a point in the article where you were saying that if we hadn't advanced the technology to the extent that we have, and if we were still back at the level of the 1950s when, you know, my dad was farming in the 1950s, but if we were still at that level, there's some huge number more acres we would have had to come up with. Could you explain that? I think both in grain and other crops and livestock too, that there was a huge difference that we would have had to miraculously, I guess, produce more land to grow
right,
as we did if we were still at those levels.
Right. So what I did is I went to the USDA data and I went back to the 1950s. And I just tried to measure productivity back in the 1950s. And basically, in the case of something like corn or wheat, it would be yield. How many bushels are we getting for each acre? And I just looked at the average yield, for example, in the 1950s. And then I just asked a simple question. Given that yield, how much land would we need today to produce the amount of bushels of corn we actually got today? And so it's a little bit of a back-of-the-envelope calculation, but when I do that, you end up with these calculations which suggest we would need way, way more land if we had the same kind of technology, the same kind of yields that we did in the 1950s. So it's something like twice as much land, for example, for corn than we have today. And I do the same calculation for wheat and soybeans. So I think the point there is just that these improvements in yield, and what is yield, it's just a whole set of both practices on the farm and technology on the farm, knowledge, what we know today, genetics, all kind of combination of things. It's not just a single thing that it's allowed us to produce a lot more food using fewer resources. And we can do the same kind of calculation for animals. I do a calculation for beef cattle and for milk as well.
Well, let's talk about the rest of the food for a bit too, because I understand how you can do that with corn and soybeans and say, you know, wheat and perhaps rice, cotton as well. It's not food, but you know, it's also. But they're big commodity crops, mm-hmm. if you will, or what we've often referred to commodity crops. Does the same logic extend to the other 300 crops of vegetables and fruits and so forth? Because it's easy, I think of this large scale improvements in these four or five big commodities. But does it extend throughout the food chain?
Yeah, so I would have loved to have done a similar calculation for a variety of fruits and vegetables, whether it's, you know, tomatoes or even sweet corn or lettuce, for example. The unfortunate reality is that the USDA hasn't kept data on, you know, acres planted and on, you know, and on output going back that far. So there just simply wasn't enough data to make that kind of calculation. The one commodity I could find that went back that far was sweet potatoes. And I got a very similar calculation with sweet potatoes when I put it on a percentage basis. So for example, I calculate that we, you know, would need about 70% more land to produce the same amount of sweet potatoes today if we were using the 1950s technology. So, you know, I don't know for sure whether the same trend would hold if we looked at other fruits and vegetables. I would love to be able to do the calculation. Unfortunately, we just don't have the data to do it. The one thing that I did work into the piece, though, and I think is really challenging for most consumers to think about, is I did find a really nice USDA data set that looked at the sizes of different kinds of farms, and they did have a fruit and vegetable production. And actually, if you look at the median-sized farms, so sort of the average-sized farm, it was, you know, well over 1,000 acres for a lettuce producer, and something similar for tomatoes. And both, you know, the vegetables I could find were higher than the average farm size for corn and soybeans. Well, not average size, again, the median size.
That's going to surprise a lot of people. And by the way, I might be able to add something on the tomatoes. I'm familiar with processing tomatoes, which is 90% of how we use tomatoes for soups and sauces and you know, pasta sauce and ketchups and all of those things. And the yields there have gone up just in the 15 years I've been paying attention, almost double, huge increases without genetic modification, without it's been irrigation, it's been, you know, better varieties and things like that. Same thing with almonds. I've got some years of experience with almonds, and they've had some huge production increases over the last 20 years as well.
Yeah, that's why, you know, it was interesting for me to be able to find that sweet potatoes, for example, did something very similar. Again, an example where they're not being genetically modified. I don't know that much about sweet potatoes, so I don't know what's causing the increase in productivity, but there's something going on there. It's, you know, different production and management practices, and I assume some better genetics, among other things. But, you know, this whole issue about the, you know, perhaps being surprised at the average, the size of the median tomato farm, for example, that was another thing I kind of wanted to highlight a little bit. You know, I don't have anything against, local foods or organic foods. I think there's room for all kinds of producers to be engaged in the food production system. And I think that's sort of one of the things I wanted to argue here is that if we want to really make big strides in improving the environment, we got to pay attention to the people that are actually producing most of the food that most people eat. And there is a huge difference in what, say, the USDA calls a farm and then who produces the bulk of the food. So the statistic I cite in there is that about 8% of all farms produce 80% of the value of all agricultural production.
Whoa. Slow down again. Yeah. 8% of all farms produce 80% of the food production.
Exactly. Of the dollars, if we added up all the dollars from food production. So you have a relatively small group of farmers. In fact, if I count the number of them, it's only about 160,000 of them. So this relatively small group of farmers. I think the way I tried to state it in this piece of the New York Times was it's like the population of a small town like Springfield, Missouri or something like that, that this small group of farmers is producing 80% of the value of ag production. So again, there's nothing against the 20, the 80% other farmers who are producing 20% of the output. That's all fine and good, but you know, this there's a small group of people that are producing a huge amount of output. And if we want to make sure that we are having good, sustainable outcomes, that we are producing in an effective and efficient way, we really ought to pay attention to these folks and bring them into the conversation, too.
Well, that reminds me. I was bringing them into the conversation recently. I often go to the farmers markets and talk to the farmers that are supplying the farmers markets and actually buy some food there, too. And one that goes to farmers markets and CSAs, and I think he's working really, really hard and has a well-respected business, I was asking him about what it's taking him for a relatively small acreage. I don't know exactly the acreage, but he has over 60 employees. Mm. And it's a, you know, they're loading trucks at 4 a.m. to go to various farmers markets and the CSAs. But I think of growing up on a livestock farm back in central Illinois, one of the reasons we all had to get bigger and get bigger equipment is you couldn't hire 60 people. There were, you know, they go to a Caterpillar and get a job at working at the factory.
Yeah, I think there is a lot of romanticism about farming and farm operations, and that's one of the things I'm sort of trying to dispel a little bit in this piece is that, you know, if you really want to be able to make a living farming today, it's a business, and you have to do what you said that your friend did and be a productive manager in addition to being a productive farmer. And especially when we think about these new technologies that are coming along, for example, like the precision agricultural technologies, the big data, if you will, it's big, complicated stuff.
Why don't you explain that? How would you define big data? I mean, people hear that word being thrown around a lot, but what's the best way to describe it so that people can understand big data, if you will, what it is and how it applies to farming?
Yeah, well, it can be a bit of a buzzword or jargon. So let me just give you some examples, and maybe that'll help flesh out what I'm thinking here. So one of the things that probably a lot of your listeners have heard about are yield monitors. So a lot of times as combines go throughout the field today and they're harvesting corn or wheat or something, they're calculating on the fly how much, you know, how many bushels are getting, you know, at each acre of land as they go throughout the field. And they produce these really pretty yield maps. And I'm sure if you just Google one and look on Google Images, for example, you can find lots of these. It's just a picture of the field, and it's really pretty. So it might be really dark green in the areas of the field that are most productive, and then it'll be, you know, kind of, you know, different shades down to red where, you know, certain areas of the field weren't yielding anything at all. So that's useful knowledge on the one hand, but that's only one piece of information. So what some of these companies are starting to do, and I should put in a pitch for the book I had come out just a month or two ago. It's called Unnaturally Delicious. And in that book, one of the things I talk about are food and agricultural innovations. And one of the chapters in that book, I talk about a company that's here in Stillwater, Oklahoma. It's called SST. And one of the things they do is they combine all these sorts of data from yield monitors, like I just mentioned, with other data that's tied to geography, the exact position. So the other kinds of data they might match up with would be something like soil sensors. So farmers might have sensors in the soil that are telling you how much water is in the soil. They might do soil tests throughout their field, so you know how much nitrogen and phosphorus, for example, are in different parts of the field. And they can match those things up with the yield data, and that's when it sort of starts becoming big data because you're combining all sorts of data together. Of course, different farms are using different fertilizers, different seeds, and so it's this, you know, big, huge set of data, but it's all being combined in a way that can help you make decisions. So, for example, one of those decisions you might have that the next year you come along, you look at all those pieces of data from the previous year, and you might go out when you decide next year, well, I'm going to plant a different variety of seed in different parts of my field. And in fact, there's a few sort of modern planters that today that can do that on the fly, plant two different varieties of corn, for example, while you're going throughout the field. The more common practice is variable rate fertilizer application. So rather than just spraying a blanket amount of nitrogen fertilizer throughout your field, what a crop consultant or a farmer may do is they're going to download a plan on a thumb drive of what they want to happen. They'll put that into the fertilizer sprayer, and as it's going throughout the field, it's moderating how much it's putting in different areas based on this information that's coming from all these different sources. And so the hope there is you're not spraying too much fertilizer in areas where you don't need it. And those areas that could make productive use of that fertilizer, it is taking up more fertilizer. So the hope there is we can both get higher yields, so we get more food, but also maybe we won't have as much nitrogen runoff, so we're not spraying nitrogen on areas of the field that don't actually need it. Now, the research, I would say, honestly, is a little bit mixed. It isn't the case that you always end up using less nitrogen than you did before, less fertilizer, but it certainly gets applied in different areas of the field. And so what I think, you know, they're sort of starting to do some research on is, you know, still could cut down on runoff, for example, if the plant is able to take up more nitrogen in those areas of the field where it needs it and you're not putting it out in these other areas that don't need it. So that's just one example, but of course there are many, many other examples in, say, animal agriculture with cattle, for example, that the sort of similar kinds of data are being brought to bear.
You know, Jason, one thing I wanted to come back on is the size of operations, because I've heard some saying that some farms are kind of like right-sizing, that there are some areas of the country where I hear stories of farmers that are saying, okay, I've been really, really big, and it's not all it's cut out to be. Mm-hmm. And so you had people that were putting their equipment on flatbed trucks and going over three different counties and saying, wait a minute, maybe I can right size and get down to, I don't know, maybe a couple thousand acres instead of 10,000 acres, and it makes more sense. Is that a trend?
So the answer I'll give is I don't know. You know, we have a concept in economics called economies of scale, and the idea there is that as you get bigger, that your sort of average or unit cost can fall. But there's also a concept called diseconomies of scale, and you can get too big. And you can imagine, you know, certainly in big companies, for example, you get too big, you get a lot of bureaucracy, people's input isn't heard as well, and so you can get so big that you aren't as effective and as efficient as you could be otherwise. So I'm sure that can be the case in different kinds of agriculture, depending on the technology and depending on what's happening in any given location. Another thing too, I think that's important to say is, it depends how you get big. If it requires, taking on huge amounts of debt, for example, just to get bigger, that's not necessarily a better thing to do. And indeed, if we look at commodity prices today, they're much lower than they were a few years ago. So if you ran out and took on a whole bunch of debt, and then all of a sudden you got to repay it back given these really low commodity prices, you're going to be in pretty bad shape. And so I think it's not always the case, as you point out, that getting big just for the sake of getting big is going to be worth it. But what I'd say is, in some cases, some of these technologies are of the sort where there are going to be some economies of size. So, just to take a kind of trivial example almost, if you have a combine, modern-day combine today is going to cost you $400,000. Well, it's not going to make sense to buy a $400,000 combine unless you can spread that cost over a lot of acres. So just like when we went from mules to tractors that allowed a given worker to use a lot more land, that made sense to sort of get bigger because the technology permitted it. But it's not always going to be that way, and I can certainly imagine cases in the U.S. where we're picking a right size, a smaller size, a manageable size is going to be the right move in a lot of cases.
Well, let's switch to livestock for a minute, because I think there's a lot of concerns that keep getting expressed on how big the broiler, the chicken operations are, egg laying operations, and pork seems to be getting an awful lot like the chicken industry. So people see it just getting larger and larger and larger. Is that pretty much the case? Are the concerns expressed about these much larger livestock operations? Is there any reason for that concern?
Yeah, I mean, there are legitimate concerns. I mean, they're mainly twofold. Animal welfare is one, and then the other big one, of course, is when you concentrate that many animals in one place, you've got a lot of manure that you have to deal with, which becomes an issue. So first let me make one statement, which is, if it depends on the species we're talking about. So beef cattle production, for example, is still largely a pretty, decentralized and sort of industry. There are a lot of still small producers and some big ones too, of course, but they're located all across the U.S. And so that industry is not nearly as consolidated or concentrated as these other industries. And I would say both in terms of animal welfare too, beef cattle largely to this day, there's a lot of, cow-calf mom, the mama cow operations with their babies still live generally on ranches where they feed on grass that they aren't tightly confined. And it's only in the last 100, 150 days or so where beef cattle are brought into a feedlot. And even there, the animals are being fed really high-quality ration diets that they like to eat, and they have quite a bit of room they can move around. So I'd say in terms of the animal welfare issues, that beef cattle still, rates pretty highly, despite some of the concentration issues. Now, again, when you bring a lot of animals into a single place, you're gonna have a lot of manure that you have to deal with. So there's been a lot of regulations in a lot of places to deal with those. It's caused changes in where the industries are located because of sort of, you might call it regulatory arbitrage, for example. These animal production facilities will have manure lagoons, for example. And one of the things I've talked about in my piece is, one of the things you can do with these manure lagoons is you can turn that manure into electricity or into some form of energy. By using something called an anaerobic digester. So you put some bacteria or other microbes in with the manure, it can convert that manure to methane, which can be turned around and used to create electricity on the farm. And so that's one thing some farms are doing. It's not always economically feasible to do it. In other words, it costs more to create the electricity than you could buy the electricity for otherwise. But there are some states and some federal programs that provide some subsidies for producers to build those sorts of things. But it remains an issue. I think those are difficult issues. And, some of that manure is used even on organic farms. So organic farms, it's not as if they don't need fertilizer. They do need fertilizer, and that fertilizer often comes from these confined animal feeding operations. And there are ways, like in Oklahoma here, for example, a few years ago, there was a kind of an exchange that some folks at the university set up for people that were trying to get rid of poultry litter and farms that needed it for fertilizer purposes, to try to match those people up so they could marry up there in a productive way. But, you know, it remains an issue. The animal welfare issues are challenging, too. I see changes in both egg laying and in pork production industries over time. A lot of that is a result of consumer demand issues. Sometimes it's big producers like or buyers like McDonald's or even big grocery store chains. Like Walmart, for example, recently came out and said that by some date in the future, they plan to make all their battery cages, all their eggs from production systems that don't use battery cases, where they're quote unquote cage free. So I think there's some pressures on those groups to make some changes. It's just not obvious what the alternative is. And I've written a book on animal welfare too, and that's one of the challenges is there are real trade offs here that in a battery cage system for egg layers, for example, you got a lot of hens tightly confined in a cage, and that sounds terrible. When you go to open barn system, the so-called cage-free system, well, bad things with that too. You get a lot of dust and ammonia in the air, which is bad for the workers and bad for the chickens. And depending on the management in one of those houses, you can have higher death rates too. So the birds have more space, more freedom of movement, but they might suffer from some other problems. You typically are going to need more land and more chickens to produce the same amount of eggs in that kind of cage-free production system. So there are no easy answers to these things, and there remain challenges. And back to this issue of size, you know, last year we had this big bird flu case where especially in the upper Midwest, this strain of this disease that they think came in from wild birds infected a bunch of the poultry and egg-laying flocks. And you know, it was pretty devastating there. And I heard even some people read some stories where people in the industry were saying, you know, maybe we need to rethink how many hens we're putting in a given location, because if they catch disease, then every bird in the house has to go. And now whether it actually translates into changes into smaller housing systems remains to be seen. But it was interesting to me that event caused some folks to sort of maybe gave some folks some pause about how many animals they might want to have in one production facility.
Well, and I would suspect, too, that just being bigger creates new challenges of management. Mm-hmm. Back when the farm, you or I had a farm 40 years ago, you'd walk out and look out over your whole farm and you make decisions as a manager, you personally kind of there, literally hands-on. And if you're spread out over four or five states with different operations, I mean, that's a different challenge of management, you know. And so any mistake that happens with a big operation is by definition a big mistake, I suppose.
Well, possibly. You know, there's a famous economist that's now deceased. Ronald Coase was his name, and he won a Nobel Prize many years ago. But one of his most famous articles asked the question, why do we even have businesses to begin with? Like, you know, why wouldn't if you were a farm, for example, why wouldn't you just, you know, do everything yourself or contract out the labor? Why would you ever hire somebody? of course, that's a difficult question to ask. It probably explains why you got a Nobel Prize. But it's centrally related to the question that you raised. And that is, you know, when does it make sense? Or why would you see these forms of business where people would, you know, take an employee on rather than just that employee going off and starting their own business? And, you know, the answers people like Coase gave related to issues like transactions costs and whether you had certain assets that you needed to use in a specific way. But these are really deep fundamental questions that economists and people in management have been struggling with for years.
One more to struggle with, and I hesitate to bring it up right now, but we've gone this long without talking about GMO, but genetically engineered crops are, I mean, really, there's only 8 or 9 that are approved out of, what, 350 different varieties of crops that we grow in the United States. And it seems like there's a lot of controversy on that. Jason, we should call back sometime and have a whole talk on that, because I know you've spent many, many hours in these kind of conversations. But that technology is evolving, too, isn't it? There's a new technology, I think it's called CRISPR, that is perhaps going to be less controversial than...
Possibly less controversial. I hate to make a prediction about that, too, but it could be in the sense that, it, you know, a lot of the biotech products we've had on the market today did involve some quote-unquote foreign gene, sort of transgenics, if you will, whereas this CRISPR technology doesn't involve any so-called foreign DNA. Now, whether that distinction is important or not, I'm not sure, but it does have the potential at least to alleviate some of those kinds of concerns. You know, for me, I think in thinking about these issues like CRISPR and other things, that there are two things that come to my mind that may affect the public's perception and how this technology moves forward. And that is, number one, who is the technology primarily benefiting? And what we saw, I think, out of the early technologies, sort of the BT corn, if you will, or the herbicide-resistant corn and soy, maybe mainly soybeans, was that, you know, the primary beneficiaries were farmers, and often those bigger farmers that wanted to use those technologies. And then, of course, the seed and chemical developers. Those were the primary beneficiaries. And yes, consumers benefited a little bit through prices that would have been lower than they would have been otherwise. But that's not obvious to the consumer. It's not, you know, clear to the consumer that they are benefiting in any meaningful way. And so to the extent, you know, biotechnology or something like CRISPR can, I think, produce more meaningful, tangible benefits to consumers, I think that possibly we'll see more adoption. So, and we are starting to see some of these technologies on the market. They include things like in potatoes, like a non-browning potato and a non-browning apple. So you cut the apple and it doesn't brown anymore. So people are concerned about issues like food waste, for example. It's something that could help out on that. Most of y'all are probably familiar with the golden rice example, but this sort of nutrient fortification is another possible, you know, avenue. And so it's, you know, there are many more examples, but to the extent I think companies start creating these technologies that benefit the consumer more directly, there's probably going to be more openness to thinking about where they might fit in our dinner plate. And the thing that goes along with that too is I think at least some of the aversion to some of these biotechnologies has just been aversion to this big agriculture that we've been talking about and the big sort of seed and chemical companies being involved. I personally don't share a lot of that aversion, but I understand where it comes from, and I could see how people could be worried about sort of monopoly in the seed sector. And so, you know, are we going to have new entrants here? Will the new technologies allow startups to come in and do something really different and unique? You know, I think those kind of technologies, again, might be something that's a lot more acceptable. And I think one thing that's a little frustrating for me as a public university scientist is I am here at a university and I see things my colleagues are working on that are really interesting that could really make some real benefits to the environment. Cut back on fertilizer use, for example, if you could come up with a wheat variety that utilizes nitrogen more efficiently, or that's, you know, resistant to a certain, you know, fungus that's invading wheat, then we don't have to spray fungicide on the field. Those technologies exist, or they're at least in development. But, you know, as a small university, you know, we don't have the resources to commercialize those things. And so we've created a regulatory system that's really hard to get these things, you know, into the pipeline. And that actually kind of helps some of the bigger players that are already in the market. And so I think that we got to be really careful when we call for more and more regulation, that one of the things that does is also keep out entrepreneurs and university scientists and nonprofit groups who have a lot of interesting potential technologies. So what we need, I think, to do is to create some kind of balance where we can both allow and evaluate these new technologies. I'm not saying they shouldn't be studied. I think nobody's really making that argument. But that it could be studied in a way that it doesn't create and convey market power to the groups that a lot of people are worried about.
Well, and people are concerned. Consumers have seen examples in the past that they're not sure they can trust, say, like most recently, the CEO of Wells Fargo getting grilled by Senator Warren on some of the things that they did. And people just suspect that the big companies in agriculture are able to have their way because it does, like you say, it takes bigger and bigger companies. People worry that the government is staying in front of them. And I'm just curious, as an economist, when you see the consolidation that's taking place, we're going from like six companies in seeds and fertilizers and pesticides down to three if all of the mergers go through that are in the process right now. Is there reason to be concerned about that degree of consolidation, do you think?
certainly there's reason to be concerned. I think then what you have to do is marry up that concern with the evidence, whether it's going to produce kind of bad outcomes. And again, it's you're back to trade-offs. You know, there are no solutions, only trade-offs is another statement you might hear other economists make. And so the downside is that when you have more concentration, there's more potential for companies to be able to exercise the market power. In other words, charge those farmers a higher price than they would have been for that seed than they would have otherwise had to pay. So that certainly is a possibility. Whether that happens or not, you know, remains to be seen. And it depends on how these firms compete with each other. So yeah, there, you know, people always talk about Monsanto, but they forget about all the others, Bayer, DuPont, and Pioneer, and Syngenta, and, you know, so there is competition here, and it depends on how these firms compete with each other. So the downside would be, you know, is there a chance that this consolidation gives these companies some power or control over the price it sets for seed? And then what you have to do is say, okay, is the potential cost from that worse or better than can these companies, by combining, streamline? So they both have sales forces out there. They both have, you know, big groups of managers. Can they, if they get rid of some of those, it might make some cost efficiencies. And it might allow them to be more innovative, perhaps. And so, you know, there are these costs and benefits, and you got to kind of weigh one against the other. And, you know, this is a sector that's still pretty new, and I'm not really sure that we know what the outcome would be. There are some, I've seen a lot of studies that look at this issue in the livestock and the meat production industry, where you have also a pretty high level of concentration. So, for example, you know, in beef and pork for a long time, it's been that, you know, probably the top four companies sell 80% of the output. And so when you look at the studies, the high quality academic studies that have been done in that area, what you'll see is, yes, there's probably been a little bit of market power. Those companies have been able to, you know, buy for lower prices than they would have had to otherwise. But that by getting bigger, these economies of scale that we talked about have way more than offset whatever market power they might have had. So that they got more efficient. They adopted new technologies. They got, you know, higher economies of scale. So that actually lowered the prices that you and I as food consumers had to pay. So, again, I think it kind of gets back to a trade-off. And, you know, I am not somebody who is an expert on the sort of industrial organization of the seed sector. So I'm not going to claim to know whether those benefits of that concentration are going to be higher than the potential costs that come about through some market power. So I'll leave that to some of the smarter guys in the profession to answer that issue. But, you know, generally as economists, those would be the things I'd look at to try to see where the potential downfalls might be.
Those conversations will have to continue. We'll have to look into them some more, because I know people too are going to be worried that as these companies get bigger and bigger and bigger, can government stay in front of them? It's a double-edged sword, because the more they're regulated, the more only the big companies can do it.
If I can add one thing there, sure, that I think is really important, and that is, you know, can government stay in front of them? I don't know, but let's make sure that we don't erect barriers to entry, because what you want to do is to make sure that anybody can compete with them. That's what we want.
Yep.
We don't want to create a system so that we keep out competitors. And that gets back to my statement about the university scientists and the nonprofits that have all these technologies, is I think we've created a regulatory system that's actually keeping out competitors.
Yep.
So let's think about a system that allows competition, that doesn't create any barriers to competition. If somebody gets bigger because they earned it and because they're just better, there's nothing wrong with that. As long as they're not creating artificial barriers to entry, we're keeping out competitors. And so that's the thing I want to make sure that we have, is a system where people are free to compete, to be entrepreneurial, and to innovate, and to try to steal their customers away. That's the kind of system I'd like to see.
Well, Jason, I tell you what, I really appreciate this conversation. Most people, when they know we're talking farm-to-table talk, don't really necessarily think about all of the big picture of agriculture. And as you point out, that's where most of all of our food is coming from. And you've done a lot to help us understand it in the conversation this morning. But even more, you've written a book, two books, maybe more. Where do people find your book?
Sure. So one thing, I blog regularly under my name. This is Jason, Jason Lusk, LUSK.com. But the two books that I mentioned here, the first one was called Unnaturally Delicious, and you can find it on Amazon. And the other one about animal welfare that I mentioned is called Compassion by the Pound. And both of those you can find on Amazon or Barnes & Noble or anywhere else you normally buy books.
Dr. Jason Lusk at Oklahoma State University, really appreciate your being on Farm to Table Talk.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Thanks for joining the Farm to Table Talk podcast. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter and subscribe to listen regularly on SoundCloud or iTunes to Farm to Table Talk.